From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it. Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, writer, director, actress, Lena Dunham, has been known by names as Una and Aura in her film Tiny Furniture. First of all, Lena, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's very, very exciting.
And the film was quite a sensation at this year's South by Southwest. But before we start talking about the film, I love these sort of slightly art-damaged names that you give all your characters.
I can't stop. It's really funny because the first movie I ever made, I've calculated all the names I call them, and I've never given myself a name that didn't end with the letter A. First, in the first short I ever made, I was called Georgia. And then I was called Ella in the first feature I made, and then Una, and then Aura, and then... Now it's the show I'm working on. I called myself Hannah, which is actually a normal person's name for the first time. But it's true. It's like, I think it started because I was trying to think of names, like what could be a name that was like Lena but different? Like what would the same person who would call their kid Lena? And what I came up with was so much weirder, I think.
But these names, they feel like the kind of names that sort of bohemian art parents might give their privileged children.
And also maybe think weren't that weird. Like there, you can imagine a parent who would call their child Una or Aura and not think it was the same kind of thing as calling your daughter Apple, for example. You know what I mean? Like, but they're just as subtly off.
And the character Una comes from Delusional Downtown Divas, the web series. Which you did 2 seasons, by the way.
I did. That was some of the most fun that I've ever had in my entire life. That was a web show that I did with 2 of my best girlfriends who I've known, one of whom since I was born and one since I was 3. And it was a web show that we did. It started out as just literally a way to amuse ourselves in my friend Isabel's living room and sort of turned into, I mean, it wasn't a phenomenon, but it was amazing because it tapped into something. The art world, for a place where so many goofy things happen, there haven't been that many things kind of calling the art world out on their BS, and people within the art world were kind of weirdly responsive to that.
You have quite a few cameos, and did people respond right away to what it was you were doing with Delusional Downtown Divas?
I think honestly what made it possible for us to get cameos at first was just the fact that we would be like, there were a lot of people who we'd known since we were little kids because we'd been skulking around galleries and they were kind of like, okay, we'll indulge your little pet project. And then after people saw that it was sort of, there was something a little sort of biting about the commentary, they were either really into it and really wanted to support it and really sort of thought, oh, this is something people need to see, or they thought, this is really cheeky, I don't like it at all. So there was kind of two camps of people, but it was really interesting because all of these adults who we'd known as little kids at first kind of just indulged it like, it's this cute thing our friends' kids are doing. And then after a while sort of started to think, okay, we want to get on board or you're going to make fun of us too.
Well, one of the things though about just watching this stuff is that the comedy gets more and more specific the more projects that you do.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's interesting. With Delusional Downtown Divas, it was this thing where I was telling someone recently, the comedy of that was interesting because to me it felt really kind of broad and sitcom-y, but it was about such a specific world. So it was like a broad sitcom about a world that only 300 people get the jokes in or something. So, for example, our episode where we did it, where Joan Jonas made a cameo and we thought it was the funniest idea in the world that these girls were so stupid they thought she was the mother of the Jonas Brothers. But it was this funny contradiction where people who know who the Jonas Brothers are don't know who Joan Jonas is, and people who know who Joan Jonas is don't know who the Jonas Brothers are. So we were sort of operating in this weird in-between space where the 20 people who did get the joke really got the joke, but everybody else was sort of like, okay, so there's some girls in funny outfits walking around.
Who at some point are always waking up.
That's a really good point. Well, they're big nappers. Things we knew about them initially is that they just, like, love to nap. They love to smoke pot. They love to have snacks. Like, they're, I'm a Taurus, and I've always been told, not to be a hippie, but I've always been told Tauruses like the, like, physical pleasures of life. The Delusional Downtown Divas like the physical pleasures of life, which is, like, they like sleeping, eating. They like having sex, but they don't ever get to do it because they're losers.
Well, my guest, who is not an archetypal Taurus, is Lena Dunham. Her new film as director, writer, and star is Tiny Furniture. And one of the things about that title is the title is so evocative.
It was interesting. The way the title came to be was actually that I had basically lied and said I had already written a script. I told a few people, they were like, so you're going to, after I'd made my first feature, a few friends from South by Southwest were like, are you planning to make another feature? And I said, I am, and I finished a script and I'm just polishing it up. And I knew that there was a script that I wanted to write, and I sort of knew the general direction that it was going to take me. But for some reason, I don't know why, I just had trouble admitting, yes, I have an idea for a movie, and no, it's not written yet, just because it was still. And one day, Kyle Martin, who eventually produced Tiny Furniture, said, well, what's the new script called? And I said, just blurted out, it's called Tiny Furniture. It was almost as if it had come from outside myself and just channeled through my mouth. And then after I said that, that was what it was called, and I wrote the script in the week following that, because it was too shameful to name a script and not have it exist.
Well, we should have you tell the audience what Tiny Furniture is about.
Tiny Furniture, just plot-wise, is about a girl who's just returned from college. She's spent 4 years at liberal arts school in Ohio, and she spent the summer there with her boyfriend, and they've broken up, and she returns pretty wounded to her family home in Tribeca, where her mom and younger sister have sort of stayed busy, and to her, it feels as though they've all but forgotten about her. And so it's sort of about her effort to reintegrate herself into her family and to kind of figure out the next steps in her life, job, boy, work, and the challenges of all of that.
But I just think that in this film particularly, as well as the other stuff you've done, that sort of chasm between who you are when you're by yourself versus who you think you want other people to think of you as really came to the fore in Tiny Furniture.
Well, it's interesting. In the Tiny Furniture, the character tells a few lies, and that was the first time that I'd had characters sort of lying to themselves or deluding themselves, but this was the first time that the character had really told untruths to other people. And that's
was conscious of it being untruth.
She tells lies to her mother. She tells lies to the guys she's dating. That was a really clear manifestation of this sort of thing that I felt like I'd been exploring before, of sort of who. It was sort of the first time a character had been conscious of the fact that she wanted people to think she was other than she actually is. Whereas in Delusional Downtown Divas or in another web show I did, Tight Shots, or in my first feature, the characters don't really understand that who they are and who they appear to be.
It's just this kind of vague search for fabulousness for these other characters.
Exactly, exactly. Vague search for fabulous, and sometimes a belief that they'd found fabulousness, whereas...
Well, the world hadn't found out how fabulous they were.
Exactly. The world was just waiting for what they had to offer. Whereas with Aura, I think that she's very aware that she's not what she wants to be yet.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to someone who has become what she wants to be yet. If I can confuse things grammatically, it's writer, director, actress, Lena Dunham. Her film is Tiny Furniture. But I was fascinated by that partially because I just thought in this feature, compared to your first, there are more dramatic moments. I mean, the sort of moments of really trying to figure out what she wants to be versus who she actually is.
Yeah. Something that was interesting with Tiny Furniture was that when I wrote it, I really wasn't sure whether it was a drama or a comedy, and I'm still not sure. And I think that, you know, there's no reason why one should have to choose, but sometimes when you're directing a film, you can have a moment of sort of, if you're not really clear about sort of, at first, when you're still young and finding your voice as a filmmaker, if you're not really sort of clear about what your genre is, you can sort of feel like you're the captain of a sinking ship. You can't quite let people know the tone. But with Tiny Furniture, it was interesting because those dramatic moments lent the comedic moments a kind of weight, and hopefully the comedic moments made people feel permission to be playful in the more dramatic moments of the shoot. And so the character of Aura is you know, she's going through a lot of pain and inner turmoil, but she's also very aware of sort of she's aware enough to know that there's some kind of humor and absurdity to the trials and tribulations she's experiencing.
Well, one of the things I find fascinating, and this must kind of be a curious thing to you too, is that so many people in the interviews I've read talk about you as such a phenomenon, they've really not paid attention to the films at all.
I think there's a few things at play there, which is people really like to focus on the fact that I'm young and also on the fact that I'm female, which are two things that are, you know.
And also your background, too. And also, you're basically, at some point, the word autobiographical comes up so much you should get a royalty every time it's used around you.
Yeah. It's so funny because the amount of times where people say, is the film autobiographical? Is it semi-autobiographical? And it's funny because I feel like everything I ever write, if I were to write, you know, a sci-fi film, if I were to write a period piece, that it would be semi-autobiographical just because I don't know any other way to enter into my work. But I guess I've used so many obvious sort of references and markers from my real life that fact of just the way that I enter my writing is just so much more obvious in this specific incident. And And I knew, you know, when I cast my mom and sister in the movie, I didn't have any sense that anyone would see the movie. But I thought, if people do see the movie...
And we have to make this point that your mother and sister are playing your mother and
sister. Oh, yeah. It's so funny. I always assume everyone knows. And it's the most exciting thing to me when someone sees the film, responds to it, and doesn't know that my mother played my mother and my sister played my sister. And that was always my dream, was that the movie would stand on its own without the... You know, it wouldn't just be sort of a sight gag, like, oh, real mom, real sister, fake situation. You know, it would... But that hopefully our interactions would have some kind of weight, even for somebody who didn't understand that we were all related.
Well, because the other thing that this seems to emerge in the films is this whole kind of tribal thing, which I think is really kind of specific to New York.
Yeah.
And how you sort of claim these tribes. And this film is, compared to the other work you've done, is about somebody who really hasn't quite claimed a tribe yet. She's kind of an ostracized from the clan.
Yeah.
And doesn't quite know where she belongs in the rest of the world.
She has her family, which is her tribe. Then her mom is a part of the art world, which is really specific. And I think, you know, as a kid, I'm really close with my family. And so I always felt like they were sort of my tribe. But then also, my parents had a really, really strong core of friends and professional companions who... And to me, I thought that that was just how your adult life was supposed to be, that you were supposed to find people who did the exact same thing that you did and have this kind of, you know,
world. Around.
Like, it's interesting. The art world is the only, no one says, you know, like, they don't even call it the movie world. It's like so, it's so telling that the art world calls themselves the art world.
Well,
I think.
That sense of insularity, too, and that kind of weird sense of sort of unspoken entitlement.
Yeah. I mean... My character in Tiny Furniture, and I experienced this in my own life, felt sort of a terror at what it was going to be like to try to make an identity after they had seen adults do it so successfully. And I think, you know, not that both of my parents have been lucky. They've been, my mom's a photographer and my father's a painter, and they've been able to make their living as adults doing this thing they really love. But what I kind of picked up on even more than that was that they'd really found people who seemed to understand their take on the world. They knew other people who thought the way that they did. And it wasn't until I went to college and started to try to think about entering into the adult or professional world that I realized that wasn't a given for everybody.
And what was that like when you got a chance to go out and meet people whose parents didn't do what they loved, and that wasn't a given for people, that you just go out and found a way to make a living with this thing that means the world to you?
I mean, that was sort of a real wake-up call for me, was the moment, I think I sort of started to figure out in high school, like, oh my God, everybody doesn't have a job that they adore. Everybody doesn't have a job that can double as catharsis for them. Everybody doesn't have a job. A lot of people have a job so that they can do the other things that they love, and it's not, and their job isn't the thing that they love. And to me, one of the great terrors and one of the great motivators was realizing that I'm a very work-oriented person, maybe a workaholic would be the term, and that what I did needed to feel... You know, I needed to feel my sense of purpose in what I was doing that way. And that's not everybody's relationship to their sort of professional life. And so I think when I first left college, you know, a lot of my friends were really scared, like, and these are really natural fears. Will I stay together with my boyfriend from school? Will my friendship stay intact? Will my, you know, will I find a place to live that feels comfortable and happy? And my biggest anxiety was about, because the thing about college, but what college is for many people and what it was for me, and is that it's a chance to really sort of professionally be yourself for 4 years. Your job is almost to be yourself. Your job is to learn, but your job is really to sort of learn about who you are. And so suddenly realizing that I was going to be out of school in the world and that wasn't my vocation anymore, was that for me was the big terror.
We'll take a break. My guest is writer, director, actress Lena Dunham. Her new film, which is wowing everybody, is Tiny Furniture. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. There's more to come.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. My guest is writer, director, actress Lena Dunham, whose new film, Tiny Furniture, was a wow at the South by Southwest Film Festival. You've been there before, and what it was like going back.
I went there with my first feature, Creative Nonfiction, and that's actually where I met a lot of the people that I worked on this movie with. So it's where I met Jody Lee Lipes, who was the DP.
Right.
It's where I met my producers, Kyle Martin and Alicia Van Coovering, and editor Lance Edmonds, and one of the lead actors, Alex Karpovsky. And my first experience at South by Southwest was amazing because Janet Pearson, who's the programmer there, had really taken sort of a crazy chance by programming it almost felt like I felt like she'd done me a charity act.
That was her first year.
It was her first year programming, and she programmed my movie, Creative Nonfiction, which was, you know, 60 minutes, a very rough feature. And she was just so warm and kind to me about that weird little movie. And so it was almost like made a little investment to see if the stock would return anything or something. And so going back was incredible, because I always say, like, I've told people I'm not a party animal. I'm like a dork who likes to be home by 9 p.m. South by Southwest is the only place that keeps me out until, you know, 6 in the morning, just because the energy of that many people who love movies and that many people who in that totally, you know, Austin is a city that just makes you want to dance and eat tacos and relax in the sun. It's just the best vibe, that film festival. And it's also so, because I went to Slam Dance one year, and so I was at Sundance, and that was...
And Slam Dance is a very different place, as Park City is very different from Austin in terms of I hate to use the word nurturing, but there's a much more sort of real convivial atmosphere in Austin than there is any place else.
Absolutely. That's what I was going to say, is that even though Sundance, you can see amazing films, and there are obviously people, it's full of people who love movies, it has a more industry feeling, whereas South by Southwest is really, like, you know, I make this joke, it's civilian audiences that are just really excited to find out what is new and what is happening in independent film. And so going back, I was incredibly excited, but I was also nervous because it felt higher stakes for me in a certain way. It had been, even though it wasn't a mega budget, I'd made Creative Nonfiction sort of while still in the bosom of school. This was sort of my first adult outing. And I was really excited to be there, but I also ultimately didn't rock out in the same way that I had the previous one, because our film premiered on the last day of the festival. And so I was literally in knots, convinced the HD cam tape would break or someone would throw tomatoes at the screen or what.
That's a lot of money to spend in throwing tomatoes and stuff. Like, people could be eating those tomatoes, don't you know? But I guess, because I didn't get to South by this year, and I'm sorry I missed out, but the sense that people just really were caught off guard by this film, I just think that it really kind of announced the presence in the way that Creative Nonfiction did not.
The people that I worked with on this, my producers, my DP, everyone I mentioned, really, it was almost like I never thought of myself as a visual filmmaker. I thought of what I was doing as sort of being...
Really, you did not?
I did not. I almost always thought of what I was doing as being sort of like filming plays or something. And Jody, especially, the DP I worked with, really helped me to sort of think about how it wasn't as if he didn't impose his visual ideas. He kind of forced me to reckon with my own in a certain way. And so it was just amazing to see how much more people could connect with what I was doing when there was sort of a strong visual idea
Well, the one thing I have to say is that, I get where you're going, because one thing that's really fascinating about this movie is that there's a sense of people filling the frame, especially like in the restaurant versus the apartment.
Yeah. I don't think I realized when we were shortlisting the film, I knew we were making sort of certain choices and creating a sort of visual language for ourselves, that we were kind of creating certain grammar rules and certain, and then deciding when to break them judiciously. But I don't think I understood how much the content of the film was informing the way that we shot it until after we had already done it, and how much these kind of wide, desolate frames in the apartment with sort of, you know, sometimes my mom and sister clustered on one side and me on another, sort of the way that Jody was framing it in a way that was really, really pretty psychological.
And dealing with those things I was talking about, that sense of loneliness in her own place and not really belonging anywhere.
Yeah. And then there are certain moments where suddenly, you know, when she meets somebody who she connects with more, like her old best friend who becomes her new best friend, Charlotte, or any of the guys, suddenly, as you said, like faces fill the frame and people are connecting. And then in certain scenes that should feel intimate, we're far away. And in certain scenes that should feel far away, we're intimate. And so I think when Jody and I were making those choices, it was almost not even clear to us. I mean, we must have known, but it was almost in the moment not clear to us how much the emotional content of the movie was dictating what we were doing with the camera.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to the writer, director, conceiver, planner, and star of the film Tiny Furniture, Lena Dunham. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. You were saying during the break something really interesting, which is you basically spent the last year out with the film, talking about it or finishing it and not acting. And now that you're you're working right now on the HBO pilot.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it's like to go back to that after having been away from it for so long. You must have almost felt this kind of weird out-of-body experience talking about something and not doing it.
It was. It really was, because I never think of myself as an actress. I always think it's always like I'm writer and director.
But it's so funny you keep saying these things, whereas you clearly have a purview that maybe it's better that you're not self-conscious about it.
I mean, maybe that's a little bit of a saying I'm not an actress is a little bit of a thing. Being like, I'm not an actress, so don't expect me to do any good acting. You know, like, there may be a little bit of sort of self-protection there. And I also think the other reason is that I sort of say I'm not an actress, I'm just good at saying what I wrote, which is actually something I stole from my friend Greta Gerwig, who is an actress, who's an amazing actress. She said she saw the movie and she said, well, I'm glad you're still casting yourself. You're so good at saying what you write. And I thought that was the nicest, most lovely compliment, and it was also it was the perfect way of sort of describing often what I feel like I'm doing when I'm acting, because I guess maybe I've always had this thought that an actor should be making more choices, it should be more psychologically motivated, and I feel like for me this sort of feeling of just like jumping in and paddling around until I get to the other side and not being hyper conscious in the same way that I am while directing or while writing of what I'm doing. And that's part of why I enjoy it, because there's a certain sort of freedom that I feel in it that I don't always feel in those other capacities. And
do you not feel that freedom at all, or are you just more conscious?
I'm just
that?
More. I think when I'm writing, I think just the very nature of the act of writing or the act of directing involves more self-editing and involves sort of keeping your head in more different places at one time. Writing the first draft of something, I feel incredible freedom. When I'm writing the first draft of a script, it almost feels like maybe freedom's not the right word, but I kind of feel like I'm like walking through a desert and there's a sandstorm and I'm just like not even going to, I'm just going to get to the other side and assess what I've done once I've gotten there. And, but then the process of editing, the process of post on a movie, it all involves a certain kind of, considering all of the options, being aware in a way where when I'm acting, it's almost like, it's an escape. I just sort of everything else shuts down and I'm just kind of like, it's like dancing or something.
As you're talking about this, I'm just thinking about all the things you've done and how there's something almost photographic about the way you shoot your subjects.
I think my mom's work has had a lot more of an influence on the way that I conceive images than I ever really gave it credit for. I mean, even the way that she blocks her, she does a lot of work with tiny furniture and with tiny dolls, and even the way she kind of blocks her characters around a room. I was thinking recently, like yesterday I was shooting a kitchen scene and I was like, okay, and I was, you know, directing actors. I was kind of placing one by the counter and one at the table and one at the couch, just sort of utilizing all of the different spaces and giving people little jobs to do. And I realized that I felt like I was sort of inside one of my mom's pictures staging it. It was the most surreal thing because it was a fake apartment. It was a fake kitchen. And these were, in some sense, fake humans that I had invented. And I was putting them all around. And I think thematically we have things in common. And so that makes sense. Just sort of her work is thinking a lot about femininity and also sort of the divide between public and private self. And, you know, I could throw all kinds of theory at it, but
we got time.
But I
also about that weird thing about the perception of two dimension versus three dimensionality.
Yeah, for me, there are a lot of cinematographers I love, and Jody's. I feel very lucky because I work with him, but I'm also a huge fan of his. That's such a cool kind of feeling. I was his fan before I worked with him, and will be his fan. Well, hopefully, there will be no after, but I'll be his fan. I'm his fan, and it's interesting because something I really love about the way he shoots is that it's almost like he sets up a photo that's something that's almost like a snapshot, and then just lets people move inside of it. And so you're less conscious in some way. You're less conscious that you're watching a film, because I never realized until I started making movies how much editing can, how much, you know, a ton of back and forth cutting, and this can be a good thing or a bad thing, can remind you that you're in somebody else's sort of manipulated reality.
It's the treatment. The reality manipulator I'm talking to is the writer, director, and star of the film Tiny Furniture, Lena Dunham. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com. As you were talking about your mom's work, and one of the things that I kind of find, I was sort of getting at a little bit, that I think is very similar, just that kind of use of the way perspective sort of informs emotion.
Yeah.
And how you're really conscious, no, I shouldn't say conscious, but how when something's at the center of the frame, there's a reason for it.
Something I often think about when I'm shot listing is I think about two things. One is this going to convey, what's the simplest way to convey the information that we need to understand? And also, is the way that we've set this shot up really giving the audience a sense of whose story this is and whose moment this is? And I kind of always want them, I always, you know, especially because I like to write characters who are ambiguous and characters who aren't necessarily good guys or bad guys. I sort of always want to give the audience a person to hold on to. And so, like, when I was setting up some of the shots in Tiny Furniture with Jody, it was important to me to go, okay, this shot belongs to my mother. And even if we don't know if necessarily she's right or wrong in this specific moment, this is her moment. And let's set this scene in a way where we understand that.
See, that's one of the things that I just find so fascinating about the work is there's a real emotional sophistication in this movie that you don't often see in independent films. That basically, there's a sort of sense of presentation, and that doesn't exist in you. It's more about what's behind representation.
Well, I was just thinking today about the fact that there's so many movies I love and so many movies I think about and so many movies that I, you know, that have been educational for me. And I was thinking about this week because Jill Clayburgh, who's one of my favorite actresses ever, passed away. And I rewatched An Unmarried Woman and was thinking about what an impact that movie sort of had on me as a human, but that when it comes time for me to actually shoot something, when it's really, I'm really in the shooting process now, which is sort of something you almost, I always forget what that's like until I do it. It's almost like, as a filmmaker, and I've talked to other people about this, you block out. When you're doing all the other stuff, shooting's the best, and it's kind of why you get into all, it's kind of why you write, it's kind of why you edit. Like, shooting is the part where you're in the magic zone, and even though it's terrifying and painful, and every day has so many highs and lows, and when you're not shooting, you almost forget how much it gets you off so that you can do all the other things. But I was thinking about it because there are all these movies that really influence me, and then when it's actually time to shoot something, I don't think about any other movies.
Is that true?
I do. I can't, like, I almost forget that anybody else, I don't mean this in a way where I'm like, I forget anybody else has ever done this before because I'm the best at it. I just mean, I forget that it's something that a million people have done. And it's so such a thing for me of just sort of like, just trying to have a really genuine experience and trying to make sure that what I'm seeing through the monitor or what I'm seeing on playback after I return to the monitor to watch feels honest to me. And so all of my sort of personal education that I've given myself about movies just sort of goes out the window, but hopefully it's in me enough that it's operating there somewhere.
This has been such a pleasure. Thanks so much for doing this, Lena.
Thank you so much. It's awesome. You're the best.
No, that would be you, and you just said it. My guest is writer, director, and star of the movie Tiny Furniture, Lena Dunham. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruiz. The show is mixed by J.C. Swadek, edited and produced by Gemma Dempsey. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.